All right, the show is Talk Is Cheap. I'm your host, DJ SST. I guess our mixing board, you need to support us because we need a new mixing board or something because... the sound quality of that is fine here on the mixing board, but over the air, I notice it's a little choppy, so I don't know what that's all about. Sorry about that. All right, today, we just got in contact with the Oregon News Project, and they're loosely affiliated with KBOO as a Portland radio station here in Oregon, and they interviewed Sarah McLaughlin. She's a judge, not the singer. She's a judge for District 14, Seat 4. So there's a half hour of that that I'm going to play you about, not quite a half hour of that that I'll play you since we got the elections coming up. Not big on electoral politics, but it's important to vote right now. Just a couple of shout-outs. Colors of Air is on at 9 o'clock on Wednesdays. Does a great jazz show. You know, Elle Gaskin is doing some great stuff. She does To the Moon and Back at 2 o'clock on Saturdays. And we've just started a new weekly news show that you should be checking, that I'm hoping you're going to check out. Because we've got to get the word out here before the election. Speaking of getting the word out, Come Together Oregon, too. She's on twice a week. You can get some really great information from her on what's going on in Eugene and Lane County and how to get active here. She's on Come Together Oregon is on at 6 p.m. on Wednesdays. And she's also on Saturday mornings at 11 a.m. And just a quick commentary from me. I listen to the news quite a bit, and I keep hearing that Iran and Russia are getting into our elections. You know, this happens all the time. We've done it for years, but you know, of course they're going to get into our elections. We're trying to get into Ukraine. No matter who gets elected, I'm sure there will be a campaign in Ukraine of some kind, and you know, that's one of their largest ports. Is in Ukraine, and it's been we've supported the fascists since World War II in that area, and that's why it's been since World War II, probably since World War I, that area has been a hot point with Russia, and it's on their borders. So of course they're going to defend themselves when it comes to that. China too, you know, it's globalization, it's corporations that are the problem. It's not China that's the problem. It's corporate outsourcing that is the problem. So that's just my opinion here on Talk Is Cheap at KEPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene, Oregon, Peaceworks Independent Community Radio, also streaming online at kepw.org. Coming up, Sarah McLaughlin, judge for District 14, Seat 4, Oregon News Project. Thanks for listening. Support independent media. The show's Talk Is Cheap. I'm your host, DJ Susti. So this is a 20-minute interview with Sarah McLaughlin and Don Merrill of KBOO. Like I said, she's running for District 14. And then I'll have a few surprises for you at the end of the show. This gives me a chance to play Clean House and play some of my wacky, zany stuff. Oh, and an exclusive here on Talk Is Cheap. You know, there were some dropouts in the Amy Barrett Browning Senate Supreme Court commission. And so we have here exclusively on Talk Is Cheap the dropped out, the stuff that's been dropped out, stuff that you can't get anywhere else. We got it from an undisclosed page with the Supreme Court hearings. So there's some unreleased audio of Amy Barrett Browning's Supreme Court confirmation hearings here that I'm going to play you at the end, and some other wacky, zany stuff. So here's Sarah McLaughlin talks with Don Merrill. Sarah McLaughlin is a nonpartisan candidate running for re-election as Circuit Court Judge, District 14, Position 4. She talked with Don Merrill about how Josephine County's judicial leadership will get it through the challenges of COVID-19, why judges have leaned toward pushing defendants to obtain legal counsel rather than representing themselves. It's not just that they're a fool as a, you know, for a client when you represent yourself. She has some really good stuff about representing yourself, of why you should not represent yourself, and why judges must follow where the law takes them, even if it means going against what the people who elected them to office want. So this goes to, legitimacy of the courts. If you go too far against the populace, you cease to become legitimate, which is what we're in danger of having right now. Okay, so, and then stay tuned, because like I say, I have unreleased stuff from the Amy Barrett, I call her Amy Farrah Fowler, but anyway, Amy Comey Barrett hearings coming up. Okay, so here's Sarah McLaughlin with Don Merrill on KEPW LP 97.3.
Judge of the Circuit Court, District 14, Position 4. Ms. McLaughlin, thank you very much for talking with me.
Thank you for having me.
Ms. McLaughlin, the first question I want to ask you, ma'am, is why do you want to be a judge on the Circuit Court?
Well, so, as I think you know, I'm actually already a judge on the Circuit Court serving here in Justin County, but the reason I want to continue in this position is, well, it's pretty simple. I just want to serve my community the best that I can and with the skills that I have, and those skills happen to be my legal training and experience as a lawyer. So I don't know if you're familiar with my background, but before I was a judge, I was a prosecutor here in Josephine County. And what that means is when anyone was accused of a crime, as a prosecutor, I represented the community in the state of Oregon and proving with evidence whether that crime was actually committed and holding them accountable if it was proven, and then making the recommendation for sentencing. So my goals as a prosecutor were focused on community safety, holding people accountable, and through those tools, hopefully achieving reformation of the individual so they could be somebody who was a decent member of our community, and also to deter any sort of future poor decision-making or act that they might commit in the future. And even though I had a lot of power as a prosecutor, the tools that I had to achieve those goals were pretty limited. But now as a judge, the toolbox I have is grown substantially, especially being a family court judge. So, for example, in family court, some of the cases that we handle are what we call dependency cases. Those are cases where DHS has become involved in a family's life because there are concerns that the child or children are not safe with their parents or with their current situation. And what we can do in those situations is sort of wrap the children and the parents in services that can help address some of the root causes of those issues. And those are the same types of causes that I was dealing with on the criminal side, such as substance abuse, which has ravaged our community, or mental illness, or poverty, homelessness, all of these kinds of things that contributed to the crimes I was dealing with. I'm still dealing with as a judge, but now I have more resources and more ability to actually make the community safe and help these people get back to where they need to be so they can be upstanding citizens of our society. And also because we're such a small community, when we intervene on an individual level, we have this ripple effect. We actually can create positive change, not just for that person or for their family, but generationally, and that ripples out for our community. And so those are things we can do as being a court in a small community. Those are things that I kind of was involved in as a prosecutor, but now I can be more involved in as a judge. And so that's why I want to continue to do the same kind of work.
Your website says you were an assistant DA in Josephine County, as you said. Before that, you were a judicial intern for Boston Immigration Court. You were a student attorney for New Hampshire Public Defenders, and you were a trial and parole clerk for the Public Defender Service in the District of Columbia. You were also a paralegal at a firm in New York and a teacher in the Republic of the Marshall Islands. So I wanted to ask you, what brought you to the West Coast? What brought you to Josephine County?
I was born here, actually. I was born about, you get on the freeway, about 15 minutes south of Grant Pass proper in Central Point, which is a really small town down here in Southern Oregon. So it's not what brought me here. It's probably why I came back. And the reason I came back is because I have a lot of family here, and I have a husband, I have two stepchildren, and the world that I want to make better and use the skills to make better, I can do that here. And when it comes to making a positive change in the world, you really can do that. If you're making that change in a small community, you can do that and you can see that right away. And so when you can have that kind of power, the best place to apply it, I think, is your home. And this is my home.
You also seem to take a turn in the middle of all that, and you were a rehabilitation assistant for the Oregon Commission for the Blind. What motivated you to do that, and how long did you do that for?
So, actually, my history has a lot of different turns in it. I think it kind of looks like a smooth path when we lay it out on paper or put it on a website, but there are a lot of different turns that I took that brought me to becoming a lawyer and then to practicing as a prosecutor and then to becoming a judge. But part of my journey was, after I graduated from law school at Boston College Law School, I came back here knowing I wanted to practice in our community and be an attorney in Oregon as opposed to back on the East Coast. Well, in order to get a legal job, I needed to have already passed the bar, which is a process that takes several months of study, and then you have testing that occurs twice a year. And so I was studying at home for that kind of testing to pass the bar in order to get the legal job. But in the meantime, I needed to find a different type of job. And because of who I am and what I like to do service-type positions. And so when I was looking for a job, this position opened up at the Medford office, the Southern Oregon office of the State Commission for the Blind. And it was for what they call a rehabilitation specialist. And that's somebody who works with people who are suffering from different vision impairments, or maybe their family member is, and they're trying to get services for that person or find out resources so they can live a fulfilling, independent life. And the rehabilitation specialist is the person who is their first contact with the Commission for the Blind. So you provide referrals to community services, you kind of get their background information, provide them some education, and then you also do program screening for any programs that the Commission for the Blind itself offers, so you can help put those people back onto the path to being self-sufficient and independent. And that's something that I really enjoy doing, but about 6 months in, I sort of maxed out basically my potential in that position, and I was at a crossroads. I could either turn from having a legal career and go back to school and become a vocational rehabilitation specialist, which is somebody who would conduct one of the programs that I was then referring people or screening people for, or I could take the degree and the skills that I already have and go back into the legal industry. And so at that time I decided, you know, I'm going to see what's out there, and if anything matches, you know, what I want to do and what my skills are, then I'll stick with the legal job, and if it doesn't, then maybe I'll move on to service in a different area, like becoming a vocational rehabilitation specialist. So when I cast out some feelers, I found out there was a position open as a prosecutor in the Josephine County District Attorney's Office. So I applied, and it turned out to be a really great fit and a really great position. And that's what kept me in the legal field and not in social services.
Well, that's really interesting, because it sounds like you feel like you could have made the kind of impact you wanted to make either way, either with that kind of personal care or in the legal system.
Absolutely. I think what I do right now is actually informed by the same motivations and skills I had in that social service position, which is really working with people to understand who they are and what their needs are and figuring out the steps to put them back on the right path to achieving those end goals. And then, of course, in the court system, we have different goals than I would have had as a vocational rehabilitation specialist, but there's certainly a lot of overlap.
You say something that I think is very interesting in your introduction on your website. You say, we have a different way of life, and our elected leaders should know that, represent that, and uphold our values. Now, you're in an election, so you're going to be one of those elected leaders. But judges are supposed to follow the law, not necessarily represent or uphold. And sometimes the law wants judges to be independent of what sounds like in that statement to be community standards. Have you ever had to make any rulings that went against what the people of Grants Pass or Josephine County wanted because it was where your purest reading of the law took you?
So basically every single ruling I make, somebody is going to walk out of the courtroom without getting what they wanted. So for people who aren't familiar with what happens in a courtroom, we have what we call an adversarial system in our court of law. So we have usually at least two parties, no matter what kind of case that we have, we usually have at least two parties, and those parties are going to have opposing views. They're going to have different desires about what should happen there, and they're also potentially going to have different readings of the law. And then it's up to the judge to be the balance between those two views, and the way that we strike that balance is we determine what the law is and how these facts should be applied to the law or what the law requires us to do in that situation. And so every time I make that determination, if people have entered with a different desire or a different understanding of the law or, you know, hopeful of a different outcome, they're going to walk out of the courtroom feeling like I didn't, you know, go with what they wanted necessarily. So in that sense, yes, I made rulings that people haven't wanted, but those are the rulings that are required by law. And you're right that when I became a judge, actually the oath that I took as a judge was to uphold the constitutions of the United States and Oregon. So those are our highest authorities here. And sometimes that means that laws don't fit those constitutions and people can bring those challenges. But those are the authorities that I'm sworn to uphold. And that's what we follow in the courtroom. So people come in and they have a different desire or a different outcome. That's unfortunate because what I'm going to do is be following the constitutions and the law and upholding those things.
Now, judges are supposed to be impartial. But by electing our judges, and Oregon elects its judges, doesn't that make them political? And do we want politics and people who are supposed to be making impartial decisions?
So judges have a very long term each election cycle. We have a 6-year term. And I think that's part of why that term is so long is because we have to weather basically certain political issues. And we also have codes of judicial conduct, which both sitting judges like myself and any candidate who applies to be a judge have to follow. And those ethics codes require us not to do anything that would undermine even the perception of impartiality in the judicial system. And so by holding judges and judicial candidates accountable to those rules and making their terms longer, those are the things that are supposed to let the public know that we are impartial and allow us to feel some relief from political pressure and weather those storms and remain independent as we have to in order to be fair and effective judges.
You remind me of something. So you were appointed by Governor Brown in 2019 to fill the seat vacated by Judge Lindy Baker. You've been on the bench for 9 months, so this is your first election.
Correct.
You announced your campaign for office about 18 days ago. Your Facebook accounts and your Twitter account came online around June 24th. Do you have enough time for voters to get to know you enough to vote for you?
Absolutely. I think actually having been a part of the community and a big part of all of the institutions we have around the justice system, I actually know a lot of people. And although our digital only went online a few weeks ago, I announced my candidacy quite a while ago. We filed back, in February or early March. We've been talking to people well before now. So that's the announcement of our digital campaign. But part of the justice system isn't just the people who come into court, for example, on cases or parties or witnesses. We have a lot of overlap with community organizations and community agencies and the people who work with those communities. And, of course, those people have some understanding of who I am and what we do here in Justice Union County. And then I have pretty widespread support amongst the attorneys who work in Justice Union County on both sides of the bar, in the sense of both prosecutors, criminal defense attorneys, civil attorneys, family law attorneys, juvenile law attorneys, and those people have also been big advocates for me. So I think those people help get the word out.
You say on your Facebook page that our campaign is about people like you and me who want a fair, transparent, and just court system. Now, you know, a casual reader could look at that two ways. One could be to say that the system needs to be more fair and transparent and just. And the other way could be to say, elect me and I'll make it more fair, transparent, and just. What are you saying about the system, or what do you believe your effect on it can be?
The judges have an enormous amount of power, and that power starts not only when people walk into the courtroom, but in our control over the processes, so the back-end processes and how people are, you know, greeted by court staff and clerks when they come into the courtroom, how accessible we make legal materials, how accessible we make, you know, instructional materials. And what I am saying there is that I understand, coming from the background I have, that this is a baffling system. If you don't have the right training or the right experience, it's really daunting and it's frightening. And so when I see opportunities to help make sure that things are more accessible or that things can be more transparent, for example, when I make a ruling to explain in more depth and using not just legal terminology as I'm required to do, but regular person lingo to explain what I'm doing so that people understand what's happening and why I'm making the ruling I'm making. And those are my pledges, in a sense, is to use the power and the authority that I have to promote fairness and transparency and justice, not just by being a fair and transparent judge, but by making those extra steps and trying to be mindful of the needs that the average person has to understand what's happening in a system that has so much power over them.
You have given me the perfect segue to a series of questions I have about the way people encounter the legal system. So do you think that people know or care about or even think about judges and the legal system before they encounter it?
Having started, you know, campaigning and reaching out to more people that I don't normally encounter in the system, I think a lot of people don't have an understanding of what the judge's role is until they've encountered the system in some way. And it makes it difficult for them to know what they want out of a judge. So I think education and outreach is important in that respect, to tell people what the judges are here for and what they're trying to do so they understand the purpose of a judge in the courtroom and why we have the power we have.
People also have the right to self-represent themselves. How did a client or defendant or plaintiff communicate that they wanted to represent themselves? And then why would someone feel they could do a better job than their attorney?
So somebody was accused of a crime, and they came to court, standing at this table, will be a prosecutor at a second table next to them, and they'll be talking with the judge. Before you say anything else, would you like to be represented by an attorney? And the reason you say that first, you don't want anybody saying anything on the record that could basically come back and harm them before they even realize what's happening. And if that person says no, what the judge is going to do and let them know that what they're being charged with are crimes, and they're going to read those crimes to them as they're charged, tell them about the maximum potential penalties, because there is a lot on the line when you are accused of a crime, and make sure that they understand the maximum potential penalties. And then at the end of talking to them about the importance of having a lawyer, the judge will say, I'm telling you it is a mistake not to have a lawyer. Would you still like to represent yourself? And by the end of hearing what's on the line with the potential convictions from those alleged crimes, most people say, never mind, I'm going to have an attorney. There are some people who will say, I'm going to represent myself. And as a prosecutor, I spend a lot of time in the courtroom. And so standing there listening to people, we call this a colloquy, have this colloquy with the judge, telling them it's a mistake to represent themselves. So that happens sometimes, but nowhere near as often as people who simply can't afford to have a court-appointed attorney or hire a private attorney.
Speaking as a judge now, when a person does represent themselves, does a judge tend to view that self-representation differently than an attorney might?
I'm not sure I understand your question. What do you mean different than an attorney might?
Like you said, you know, the judge recognizes that people have the right to represent mm-hmm. themselves and doesn't deny yeah. them the opportunity to represent themselves. So is it more likely that the judge will lean toward strongly encouraging them to get representation because they just don't understand what they're in for if they choose to represent themselves?
So judges are required by law to lean toward, as you put it, having representation. And the reason we lean toward it is absolutely that if you are not a lawyer, you are, and we say this as part of the colloquy, if you are not a lawyer, you are at a strong disadvantage. The state is represented by a lawyer, and they will not have the same disadvantages as you. So we do everything we can to tell them this is a one-sided ballgame. If you are not a lawyer, because legal rules apply, and you will not be aware of those legal rules if someone is not a lawyer. It will not be fair, basically, if you can't get an attorney. And that's why we end with, so we're telling you it's a mistake not to have an attorney. Would you still like to represent yourself?
You had said people sometimes walk out of the courtroom not getting what they wanted, and sometimes those mm-hmm. people feel like they were treated unfairly. When
I don't think I said they felt like they were treated unfairly.
No, that's what I was saying. Based on some based on some of the conversations I've had with other judges and attorneys, sometimes mm-hmm. people feel like, you know, the court did not give them what they wanted, and so they feel that they were unfairly treated.
Mm-hmm.
But when people are in court, what do you think people think that justice is? Do they think that it's about retribution and penalty, or do they think that it's about rehabilitation?
Are you talking about criminal matters specifically or law in general?
I'd say law in general.
I think in general, people all feel that what the outcome should be based on truth and fairness. And that's part of the importance of transparency in the courtroom, is so that someone can understand that whatever happened in the courtroom and the result of what happened is this ruling is based on the law and what happened here in the courtroom today, so that even if they don't get what they want, they still understand that what happened was fair based on the law. Now, they may not like the law. They may want to change the law. And there are avenues to do that through, you know, their represented leaders and the legislature. But they need to understand my role of applying the law so they can understand that what I'm doing is not partial, it's not prejudice, it's not based on the individual that's wearing the robe. It's based on the law. So even if they leave not liking the outcome, not getting what they wanted, hopefully, and the goal is that they still feel that it was fair because the truth came out. And the law says that when the truth is this way, this is the outcome.
Over the years, many judges and candidates for judge I've talked to have talked about complained about, how the Oregon court system is underfunded. The legal system is undeniably critical to a functioning civil society. So why do you think it remains underfunded? And what kind of workarounds do you expect you'll have to make or continue to make in Josephine County to provide good service to those folks?
I really couldn't answer your question about why it remains underfunded. And it might just be that the need so far outstrips the resources, that we're always going to be underfunded to some degree. And so somebody somewhere makes that, you know, draws that line that this is the best we can do with what we have right now. But workarounds, that's what we do every day. Josephine County has a high caseload per judge, especially compared to other counties. And that's one of the reasons that we received that 15 a while back, because we needed additional judges in order to hear all these cases. And when we talk about a lack of resources, the courtroom really becomes the bottleneck for those resources, because you have to have a judge to hear a case. You have to have court staff to make sure everything's being recorded, to have all the appropriate paperwork filed and routed to the judge for, you know, their review. You have to have all this back-end work, but it comes out in the courtroom. That's the end result of many cases if they're not resolved earlier. And so you can only hear as many cases as you have judges in courtrooms available. So even if we added additional judges, we still have to have bigger facilities and so on and so forth. So some of the workarounds that we do try to do is implement other processes that encourage resolution earlier than the courtroom. So, for example, we have mandatory mediation in custody or divorce-related filings. So people are required to go to a mediator, an orientation, go to a mediator. And even if that doesn't work out for a lot of people, it's exactly what they needed. You know, just a third party who's not involved in either of their lives to hear their sides and help them reach a compromise or a conclusion. And so we implement little strategies like that to keep people out of the courtroom so they can get the fair result they want without having to wait to get into the courtroom. Because the side effect of having to wait to get into the courtroom is that cases build up because it takes longer for them to get resolved. And then people can't move on with their lives when they have these unsettled issues.
Right. Speaking of that need that you mentioned earlier, the whole society has been overwhelmed by COVID-19.
Mm-hmm.
If you are elected to the bench, re-elected to the bench, have you thought about what you will be facing when the system is recovered? I mean, I think about all of the things the courts normally deal with, like marriages and custody cases and divorces and bankruptcies, but also all of the new law that will come from civil liberty and civil rights challenges over things like mask wearing or the legitimacy of lockdown orders. It seems to me that the courts are going to be extremely busy for a really long time. Is Oregon's judicial system ready for it?
I can only speak of my experience in Josephine County, and I can let you know that we're actually in a better place, I think, than a lot of the other counties. So we have phenomenal leadership here in our court system, and I mean that on both the court staff side and from our presiding judge. And when I say we have a phenomenal leadership, what I mean is we have people here who really buckle down and help us come up with a policy pretty fast and implement that policy that allowed for remote hearings. So there was probably a two-week transition period where we were very slow because what we could do in the courtroom was so restricted, and we hadn't yet gotten our technological piece up and running. But once we got that up and running, we've been back to being completely busy the whole time, especially over at Family Court, because we deal with a lot of those cases that have constitutional or federal statutory timeline requirements that weren't suspended. And so we transitioned fairly quickly thanks to our leadership and the implementation of the policy. And because we had to keep going, we did keep going in Family Court. Something that we do have is these hearings have taken a little bit longer. When we're dealing with this technology piece, it just extends things a little bit longer. So we do have, in that sense, a little bit of a backlog at the Family Court just because you can't fit quite as many things, but not that big of a backlog. So I'm not as worried about Josephine County when the restrictions are lifted So we'll see this surge in cases that we won't be able to address before, since we've been addressing them all along. And I think there was a public perception that the courts were somehow closed through much of March and April, but we actually weren't. We were here, and we were working. We were just doing things in a new way.
And this is my last question. Why should the people of Josephine County vote for you?
I think it really comes down to two things. When you have somebody who has a lot of power, as judges do, you want to make sure that's the kind of person who's going to wield that power with respect to you and consistently in accordance with the law. And that's the kind of person that I have been in the courtroom before as a prosecutor and now as a judge. You also want that person to be independent and balanced. And as somebody who has a lot of support from all sides of the bar, criminal defense attorneys, prosecutors, civil attorneys, family law attorneys, I'm someone who has already shown that's the person I can be.
All right. Sarah McLaughlin is a nonpartisan candidate running for Judge of the Circuit Court, District 14, Position 4. Ms. McLaughlin, thank you very much for the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Merrill. I appreciate your time this afternoon, too.
I'm Don Merrill. Thanks for listening.
KEPW, LP, 97.3 FM, Eugene, Oregon, Peaceworks Independent Community Radio, also streaming online at KEPW.org. You've been listening to the Oregon News Project, something that KBOO has come up with. I'm sorry about that 60-cycle hum in the background. That's from them. That's their phone line, I think. But Josephine County, we're not in Josephine County, but it's still, I found it interesting how much power judges have in this time when Amy Comey Barrett is being reviewed for the Supreme Court. So coming up is some unreleased stuff from that hearing, only available here on Talk is Cheap, so stay tuned for that. But in the meantime, listen to this real quick.
21:30 hours.
Until now, the war has been conducted with honor. At this moment, brothers and sisters, the endless catalogue of bestial atrocities which will inevitably ensue from this appalling act must, can, and will be terminated. Poverty and ignorance.
principle, the war effort is always planned to keep society on the brink of starvation. The war is waged by the ruling group against its own subjects, and its object is not victory over Eurasia or East Asia, but to keep the very structure of society intact.
All right, this is Talk Is Cheap on KPWLP 97.3 FM, Eugene, Oregon, and Peaceworks Independent Community Radio, also streaming online at kpw.org. All right, as promised, here is an exclusive here on Talk Is Cheap. Unreleased testimony. This is what happened when the mics went off during the confirmation hearings for Amy Comey Barrett, sent to us by an unnamed page, Senate page, at the hearings. Only available on independent radio, so you might want to think about supporting us, because you're not going to hear this anywhere else. Well, maybe you might hear it somewhere else. All right, here you go. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends.
All right, let's talk politics, shall we? My first guest is someone I've talked about quite a bit here on Church Chat, but we've never actually met face to face. Please welcome Satan.
You can actually just call me Ted Cruz.
Oh, I'm terribly sorry about that. I was just quoting one of your colleagues, Teddy. Don't get in a bunch. You know, John Boehner, Speaker of the House.
Oh, sure. No, John's always coming up with hilarious nicknames for me, like Buster or Son of a Gun.
I believe the phrase was Lucifer in the Flesh. Yeah, a little bit different than Buster. And now you've quit the race entirely. Why do you think it didn't work out?
Well, Church Lady, I suppose the American people weren't ready for a candidate with strong Christian values. Someone like me who follows the righteous path and lives his faith every blessed moment.
Has anyone ever told you that you're just a little preachy? Just a little bit. We like ourselves, don't we? Look at that face. We love ourselves. Because we think we're just a little bit. There it is. That's that happy superior face. Because we love Jesus more than anybody.
Well, yes, I do pray to God often. And I think everything that happened was part of God's plan.
Was it? Was it God's plan for you to get humiliated by an orange mannequin? That's kind of an odd plan for God to have for you, isn't it? Tell me, Ted, man walking, what are you going to do now?
Well, actually, Church Lady, I've been thinking about turning evil for a while, you know, going to the dark side. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've been told to go to hell so many times, I think it's finally time to check it out.
Wow, well, what a fun trip you're looking forward to. Yeah. I rarely say this in an encouraging way, but see you in hell.
Thank you, Church Lady.
All right, very good. All right, our final guest today is the presumptive Republican nominee. Please welcome the Tangerine Tornado, Donald J. Trump. All right. Hi, Donnie. Have a seat. Look at you.
Hey, Church Lady. It's great to be here.
Yes.
Your place looks tremendous. Believe me, this is one classy fun house.
Actually, this is what we call a church. Something tells me that you're not a big churchgoer.
Oh, I'm a big church guy. I'm mm-hmm. there all the time. Sometimes I go, even when it's not church day.
Mm-hmm. Wow. What a well-put statement. Does Donnie ever take a gander at the Holy Scripture?
Honestly, I love all the books in the Bible. Mm-hmm. I do. They're all terrific. Corinthians part two. Book of Revelations. Two Genesis, two Furious. Which says, and I quote, love thy neighbor as thyself, and like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And always keep the Sabbath huge. That's Moses. Oh, and the part where Jon Snow comes back to life. That's great Bible.
Well, isn't that special? Donnie, there are those who say you're not qualified, and that's not true. You know, I remember a Celebrity Apprentice episode where Gary Busey didn't sell enough pancakes, and you just said, you're fired. And I thought, right then and there, give this man the nuclear codes.
A lot of people are saying that.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of observing God's commandments or not, I understand your family's here.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Get in here, guys. It's my wife, Melania.
Hello. So yes. Wonderful to be here.
My yes. lovely daughter, Ivanka. Mm-hmm.
Sort of great to be here as well.
Mm-hmm. And who's the third woman down there?
That's just another model. I mean, she's great energy to have around.
I'm sure.
Let's have fun.
It likes all kinds of flesh, doesn't it? Tell me, Donald, have you figured out who your vice president's going to be? Somebody who shares your temperament and values? Someone like, oh, I don't know. Could it be Satan? Good Lord.
I have returned.
Teddy's a demon, my God.
I am no longer Ted Cruz. I am the Demodulus, Lord of Shadows.
You sure you aren't Lord of the Weak Chins?
Stop it, Donald.
You're the first guy who got possessed and looks better.
You're such a jerk, Donald. I'm going back to hell. They're nicer there.
Well, that was an eventful church chat. Thanks for letting us chat it up with you. And right now, all I got to say is...
Brought to you by Gluteus Maximus Excon Cranium. Do you still think women and people of color are inferior? Do you think corporations care about people and the environment? Do you think George Bush doesn't know the lyrics to the Horse Vessel song? You may be suffering from terminal ignorance, made from 100% Amanita mushrooms. Gluteus Maximus Excon Cranium actually removes the brain plaque associated with terminal ignorance. Pick up some today before it's too late. Side effects are... compassion, forgiveness, and hysterical laughter.
Each week, we open with an authentic act of political terrorism. Each week, we open with an authentic act of political terrorism. Each week, we open with an authentic act of political terrorism.
Have you ever been broke?
Sure, mostly often.
All right, you're walking along. Not a nickel in your jeans, you're free as the wind. Nobody bothers you. Hundreds of people pass you by in every line of business. Shoes, hats, automobiles, radios, furniture, everything. They're all nice, lovable people. They let you alone. Is that right? Then you get a hold of some dough and what happens? All those nice, sweet, lovable people become helots. A lot of heels. They begin creeping up on you, trying to sell you something. They get long claws, and they get a stranglehold on you. And you squirm, and you duck, and you holler, and you try to push them away, but you haven't got a chance. They got you. First thing you know, you own things. A car, for instance. Now your whole life is messed up with a lot more stuff. You get license fees, and number plates, and gas, and oil, and taxes, and insurance, and identification cards, and letters, and bills, and flat tires, and dents, and traffic tickets, and motorcycle cops, and courtrooms, and lawyers, and fines, and a million and one other things. And what happens? You're not the free and happy guy you used to be. You gotta have money to pay for all those things. So you go after what the other fellas got. And there you are. You're a helot yourself.
You win, Colonel. Here, take the 50. Go out and get rid of it.
You bet I will, just as fast as I can. I'm going to get some canned goods, a fishing rod, and the rest I'm going to give away. Give away?
Hey, get me a pitcher's glove. I got to get some practice.
Hey, he's giving it away. I'm going to get me some of that.
Hey, come back here, you helot.
Each week, we open with an authentic act of political terrorism. Each week, we open with an authentic act of political terrorism.
This is KPWLP 97.3 FM, PeaceWorks Community Radio from Eugene, Oregon, and online at kepw.org.